Shabbat Shalom, everybody. I don't know how to deal with the people sitting behind me, so I'll just turn around all night. Although this is not the time for the Sivivon, we'll have to deal with this somehow. Yehuda really enjoyed, where are you, Roz? Oh, there you are. Really enjoyed what you said, as did I. I feel very flattered. And he said, since you don't have a daughter named Shulamit, you can adopt me. the other opening remark I want to make is Yehuda's family is here, his sister and her husband and two or three of the... They haven't done anything yet to deserve applause, but when you get to know them, you probably will applaud. And Jakey, the youngest here, asked me if this is going to be very long. So it won't be. It won't be. So my topic tonight is Zionism in the 21st century. I'm just going to speak this way. Is that all right?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Zionism in the... I could try that. Do I want to do this? Nah. I like being up here at the pulpit. Makes me feel terrific. Okay. So, Zionism in the 21st century is my talk, my topic tonight. But I would like to start my talk going back quite a bit further and deal a little bit with history. And since you've heard from Roz that I'm very interested in women's studies, I'm going to give you a lead up to Zionism in the 21st century by telling you about four different women. And I will give away who they are right away. Their names are easy to remember. They are Donna and Emma and Henrietta and Irma. Okay, and I'm going to tell you these people. I'll tell you something about these people, how they defined what Zionism is, and how that leads me to thinking about what it is in the 21st century. So, I'll begin with the 16th century figure, Donna Grazia. How many people have heard of her? Terrific, good education program here. She was an extremely wealthy Spanish conversa. And you should use the word conversa and not use the word Marrano, which means pig, and was used as a term of derision. You should always use conversa instead. So she was an extremely wealthy Spanish conversa who wandered from Portugal to Antwerp to Amsterdam to Italy in order to escape what? The Inquisition. Which was not limited really to Spain and Portugal, but had its reaches all over the world. So she tried to escape the Inquisition, and she ultimately landed in Kushta. What is Kushta? Istanbul. That's in Turkey, correct. And when she was there in Kushta, Donna Grazia's palace became a center where Jewish leaders, rabbis, and other learned people gathered to study Torah. She came to Kushta and she created this learning center. She herself studied with them and also established printing shops, which operated in the dark. I really know this lecture, so I could continue without seeing anything. That's okay. It is the, there we go. Yeah, or. Okay, so she was studying with, it's nice to have a little, you know, a little interruption. Okay, whoever is near that light switch though, don't lean on it again, please. So she established these printing presses at, and she donated generously to the building of synagogues and seminaries, and she paid salaries to rabbis to study the Torah. Donna Grazia conducted business with the Sultan in Kushta, and in one of their financial transactions, he gave her a city. Does anybody know what the city was? Who said that? Tiberias. He gave her the city of Tiberias. which at the time was part of the Ottoman Empire. She then decided to transform Tiberias into a refuge for Jews. So here was a city in the Holy Land, which she defined as a refuge for Jews. And so she was one of the first people who said that there should be a refuge for Jews in the Holy Land. Scholars recognize that Donna Grazia used the political support of the strongest empire of the world, the Turkish Sultanate, to reestablish a homeland for Jews, which is now in Israel. Unfortunately, she died before having the opportunity to go to Tiberias. But I want to say to you, how many people here have been to Tiberias? The next time you go, go to a hotel, which is a unique institution. It's a hotel museum. It's like you go to a museum like, what is it here? Like LA MoCA, but you could stay overnight in it. So this is a hotel museum devoted to Donna Grazia. And I would consider her one of the first Zionists. A second woman significant in the history of Zionism is probably well known to you. She is the wealthy, second wealthy person, very interesting, I think, the wealthy Sephardi American named Emma Lazarus, who lived only 38 years from 1849 to 1887 and became famous for writing a sonnet that appears on the base of the Statue of Liberty in the New York Harbor. In her 14-line poem, she extols the United States as a haven. The famous last words are, and repeat it with me if you know it, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. The wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door." It's so remarkable to me that who was it who put a poem at the base of the symbol of the United States, but a Jewish woman, a Sephardi Jewish woman, how much she understood what the U.S. stood for. Although many American school children learn this poem by heart, few know that a Jewish woman wrote the poem, and fewer still, if any, learn that she was an impassioned Zionist. In a series of articles entitled Epistle to the Hebrews, 1882 to 1883, she calls for a practical movement, this is her words, she calls for a practical movement towards alleviating the suffering of oppressed Jews in countries less favored than our own, the United States. She really embodied the phrase which the rabbi alluded to in his various remarks today, Kol Yisrael arevin ze laze. To me, this is one of the most important components, that concept that underlies Zionism. Zionism means a responsibility for other Jews, okay? Kol Yisrael arevin ze laze. 15 years after she said that there should be a movement, Emma Lazarus, in 1897, that's 15 years later, what happened in 1897? Theodor Herzl created the first Zionist Congress. The first Zionist Congress is always perceived as the beginning of political Zionism, but Emma Lazarus did it 15 years earlier. I don't want to create any competition between Emma Lazarus and Theodor Herzl, but I think Emma Lazarus deserves a lot of credit for what she did. Emma Lazarus explained, this is also very interesting, I think, that she developed her Zionist ideas as a consequence of reading a book. Which book? The book by George Eliot, who everyone knows was actually a woman, Mary Ann Evans, who wrote the book Daniel Deronda, in which Deronda discovers that he is a Jew as the book unfolds. He marries a Jewish woman, and the two of them ride off into the sunset to Palestine to see what they can do to restore the homeland for their fellow Jews. Reading that book inspired Emma Lazarus. Emma Lazarus' Zionism was very similar to ideas later developed by another great American, unfortunately not a woman, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, Louis D. Brandeis. We had to wait many years before we had a Jewish woman on the Supreme Court. But anyhow, Emma Lazarus said, and this is really interesting, I think. I think the whole thing is interesting. That's why I'm telling it to you. But some things are more interesting than others, I guess. She wrote, "There is not the slightest necessity for an American Jew, the free citizen of a republic, to rest his hopes upon the foundation of any other nationality whatsoever, or to decide whether he individually would or would not be in favor of residing in Palestine. All that is claimed from him, that is a Jew, would be a patriotic and unselfish interest in the sufferings of his oppressed brethren of less fortunate countries, sufficient to make him promote by every means in his power the establishment of a secure asylum." I'll put that in my own words. Americans don't have to make aliyah. That is what she was saying. Americans should appreciate the freedom that we have here. We can stay in this country. That's exactly what Louis de Brandeis said. But we are responsible for other Jews. And if some can't come to America to escape the problems that they're having, we have to build up this, a state, a refuge for those people. This is called Zionism for other people. That's my phrase. She called on American Jews not to bury their heads in the sand concerning the anti-Semitism in Russia. In another essay called The Banner of the Jew, she, Emma Lazarus, called on Jews to wake the sleepers high and low, rouse them to the urgent hour, and save the Jews of Russia from anti-Semitism. She wrote, I mean, it's all a little flowery because she was a poet, "The incidents of current Jewish history, the swelling voice of Jewish patriotism, the urgent necessity of escape from an untenable position among the nations have combined to transform me into one of the most devoted adherents to the new dogma." How many people here knew what a strong Zionist Emma Lazarus was? It's just not known, and it should be known. She, what?
Your nephew raised
his hand. Jakey? The platform is yours. I just wanted to say that one historian concluded thus, "To no friend of Zion, in fact, to no one in 19th century America, that's 100 years, belongs so much responsibility for keeping Zionism alive as to Emma Lazarus." Finally, she called on Jewish American Jews, and that's part of what this whole adult education program is. She called on American Jews to understand their history, to acknowledge their heritage. She was also a practical person, and she created an organization called the Society for the Improvement and Colonization of East European Jews. You understand the distinction that she's making here? The major purpose of which was to resettle Jewish exiles in Palestine. And I just want to say one other sentence of hers. There's so much to say about Emma Lazarus. "Emma urged Jews, American Jews, to come to the aid of persecuted Jews everywhere, stating, 'Until we are all free, none of us are free.'" And that's something that I feel that I kind of live by. Nevertheless, we have to understand that immigration to a reestablished Jewish homeland in Palestine was an idea that Emma Lazarus advocated for other Jews, for oppressed Jews, not for herself or for people like herself. For Emma Lazarus, Palestine was a refuge, and Zionism was primarily a philanthropic ideal for the benefit of others. So I hope you've become interested a little bit in Emma Lazarus. The third Jewish woman to whom I attribute a very significant role in defining Zionism is Henrietta Zold, who lived from 1860 to 1945. And she's famous, you all have heard of her, I think, for having founded Hadassah, the American Zionist Women's Organization. I just want to say that your day school has given the assignment to children of various ages to write about Zionism, because your fabulous adult education people include the day school in thinking about this weekend. I just thought that was totally marvelous integration. And one of the children has created a whole poster about Henrietta Zold, and one of the children wrote a whole poster about Yehuda and me, which is pretty amazing. That was pretty interesting. I'd like to meet this child and give him a scholarship to Brandeis, maybe. Okay, but I'm leaving town on Sunday. Anyhow, everyone knows, I believe, that Henrietta Szold founded Hadassah, the American Zionist Women's Organization, which deserves credit for being the largest Zionist organization and the largest women's organization in America. Can you believe that? It's really an extraordinary thing. And there's a very funny story about the early days when Hadassah was raising lots of money. And this guy, Louis Lipsky, who was a very important Zionist figure, went up to Henrietta Szold and said, "It's so nice, dear, that you're raising all this money, but you wouldn't know how to spend it. Give it to me." And she said, "No, who knew that? There you go. My sister-in-law knows the answer. No." She didn't. I mean, they didn't. Anyhow, Henrietta Szold was the eldest of 8 daughters, 3 of whom died in infancy. Her father was a rabbi and gave her the attention and education usually reserved for an eldest son. She was the eldest daughter. Even though she got all that education, this is always in her life. She has opportunities and then they're taken away. She was nevertheless not permitted to leave home to attend college. Instead of attending college and getting an education, she became a teacher. And the Baltimore correspondent of the New York periodical called Jewish Messenger, and she shined her articles Shulamit. And she wrote typically about topics outside women's domestic sphere. Later, she sponsored a very famous experiment in practical education. She created a night school for immigrants that she ran and in which she taught until 1893. Before her, people would just blame immigrants for not knowing English. She said, "How about teaching immigrants about America and teach them the language, and they'll be able to succeed." She lived in Baltimore. Baltimore is a port city, right? Emma was inspired by what she saw in New York, the port city with all these immigrants coming in. And Henrietta was inspired by the immigrants coming into Baltimore on their ships. And there she met some Zionists who had been coming. And because she found these people so interesting, she joined the Zionist Association of Baltimore in 1897, the same year in which Theodor Herzl created the first World Zionist Congress. 5 years later, when Rabbi Szold, her father, died, Henrietta and her mother, Sophie, moved to New York, where Henrietta enrolled as the only female at the Jewish Theological Seminary to study Hebrew and Talmud in order to have the skills to edit her father's manuscripts. Henrietta's acceptance was contingent on her signing a statement that she was not trying to be a rabbi. She also joined something called the New York Hadassah Study Circle, this is important, whose members prepared papers on Jewish history and held discussions about Zionism. Henrietta had an unrequited love affair with someone who had no idea that she was in love with him. And when he came over to visit her to introduce her to his fiancée, which was very sad, Henrietta just had a kind of a breakdown. And her mother said to her, "This is what you should do. What do you think it was?" "What'd you say?" "He said, break them up." "No." Anybody else want to guess? What did her mother say after she had this big disappointment? "Take a trip. Take a trip." So where do they go to get resuscitation after this miserable experience? To Palestine. Palestine was a mess at that time. Absolutely no place to go. But they went.
Well, you realize things could be
worse. That's right. That's right. Did you hear her? She says the trip made them realize that things could be worse. Very good. Very good. I'll use that the next time. Okay. During her tour of the Holy Land, Henrietta Szold was shaken by the misery and disease she witnessed there. She saw a girls' school in Jaffa where children were playing in the sand and there was a wreath of flies around their eyes. When I remember going to Israel a long time ago and seeing that myself, before there was good medical care available, Henrietta wanted to do something, and her mother said, What you're doing with your group back in New York is really not the right thing to be doing. What is the use of reading papers? You should do something practical here in Palestine. Upon return to New York, Henrietta presented this idea of a practical Zionism to her study group, and she issued an invitation to women interested in the promotion of Jewish institutions and enterprises in Palestine. And from that came the first chapter of Hadassah. At the helm of the new organization of 4,000 women. You know how hard it is to mobilize 4,000 women? But she was such a great orator, Henrietta Zold. So at the helm of this new organization, Henrietta took responsibility for organizing the American Zionist Medical Unit, consisting of doctors, nurses, etc., which all set sail for Palestine in June 18. And she was also placed in charge of Jewish Zionist education. At the end of 1919, she learned, that was only 10 years after she had the Zionist epiphany in Palestine, she learned that she was being sent at age 60 to Palestine, and she made Aliyah at the age of 60 and lived there for the next 25 years of her life working for the good of the Yeshuv, which is the pre-state Jewish community, particularly in medical areas. But what did she say about Zionism? To Henrietta Zold, Zionism was, as she called it, the balm for the wounds inflicted by history upon the Jewish people. I think that is a beautiful phrase, the balm of the wounds. And it is an ideal that can be embraced by all, no matter what their attitude may be to other Jewish questions. What she meant by that is, it's not for Reform, Conservative, or Orthodox. It's for everybody. And it's an ideal to which it is worth dedicating one's life. Zold's Zionism was similar in part to Louis Brandeis again, who had a motto. Does anyone know what Louis Brandeis' motto was for Zionism? It's great. Men, I think he meant that, money and discipline. Zold's motto might have been women, money, and discipline. Zold's aim was to organize all of American Jewish women into chapters where they would study their heritage, learn about the growing Jewish community in Palestine, and find practical ways to help. And in her case, Zionism also meant Aliyah. There is one other woman I want to tell you about, and I probably have not heard about her. Her name is Irma Lindheim. So we've had Donna, Emma, Henrietta, and Irma. Like Donna Grazia, who became an extremely wealthy widow at a very young age, so too Irma Lindheim became a very wealthy widow. Parenthetically, Henrietta Zold and Emma Lazarus were single all their lives, and Irma and Donna were married for a short time, and they became great Zionists. I don't know if there's a relationship between being single and having great ideas. but there's something about the independence that these women felt at that time because they were not in a relationship where they were seen as second class. They were all single women for most of their lives. Okay. And so was many, many other great American women like Jane Addams, etc. Anyhow, for those of us who are married, we can find some benefits in that. okay, you know. Okay, Irma was inspired to learn about her completely subdued identity as a Jew. They had Christmas trees, they had celebrated nothing. All she was, with the name Lindheim, she was perceived as a Jew. She knew nothing about her identity. But she met Henrietta Zold, became inspired, and went on to become the third president of Hadassah, an organization that she unsuccessfully tried to move into a new direction. Irma was a critic of the organization that she was a president of, which I think is interesting. She said Hadassah was overly concerned with practical issues. And she articulated a different foundation for Zionism, one that I also resonate to. This one did not focus on refuge or practical projects. Instead, she saw in Zionism and the creation of a Jewish homeland the possibility of deepening one's spiritual Judaism. In other words, it shouldn't just be a country where people can go to if they're in trouble. It should be a place, and a place that has, you know, hospitals and all the other institutions. It should be a place where Judaism can flourish, you know, a place that can have meaning in people's lives, can redefine what Judaism is now that we're back in our homeland. I think it's a very attractive idea. Israel provided Jews, she said, with the opportunity to develop Jewish culture. It provides individuals with the conditions in which they can achieve Jewish self-actualization. Like Abe Maslow said, you know, when you have all of your practical needs taken care of, then you can self-actualize and become greater than you thought you could be. Although Irma had done some preliminary studies towards becoming a rabbi, she believed that the highest expression of Jewishness lay within the idea of the kibbutz. She thought that was the ultimate in Jewishness. Why? Because kibbutz members actually touch and work the land. You know, the land is what we were trying to retrieve, and kibbutz members touched it and worked it, and they also shed differences among themselves, the different kibbutz members, enabling everyone to feel equal to one another rather than chasing material goods in order to demonstrate superiority. After a few trips to Palestine, Irma gave away all of her gazillion assets, she was so wealthy, and became a kibbutz member. There are many other people, women and men, who grappled with the question of how to keep Jews safe, how to acquire political power so as to get international endorsement for a Jewish state, how to enhance the quality of life for Jews in Palestine, and how to utilize the Jewish homeland as a vehicle for enhancing the Jewish religion and spirituality. The 19th and much of the 20th centuries focused on these concerns. But in the last quarter of the 20th century, particularly in 1975, when the United Nations endorsed the equation of Zionism and racism, a new task arose for people who are concerned with the welfare of Israel, and that is defense of the very idea of a Jewish state. As we enter the 21st century, there are renewed debates about Zionism. Some people believe Zionism is no longer necessary because the state has been established, just as people believe feminism is not necessary because some men do the dishes. I think that's a great analogy. People who hold this perspective consider themselves post-Zionists. They think it's not necessary anymore because we have the state of Israel. How many people have that point of view? No post-Zionists here, okay. But more important than those who consider themselves post-Zionists, and there are many post-Zionists in Israel today, but more important than that is the anti-Zionists, which is obviously different from post-Zionists. Zionism has become the bugaboo of the left. The left has embraced the idea that Zionism is a colonial force, a colonizing force that has displaced the people who live there and do not accept the Zionist narrative of the liberation of the Jewish people. Everyone else can be liberated, but the Jewish people don't deserve it. People on the left consider Zionist claims to create and sustain a Jewish state essentially as the movement to deny Palestinian rights. The people who criticize Zionism in this way always link it intimately to Palestinian rights. Zionism is the bugaboo, obviously, of the Islamists, who see a Jewish state in the Middle East as a thorn in the larger context of all the Islamic and Arab states. They see it as an inappropriate intrusion into their desired so-called homogeneous lands. And in a newspaper, it's very interesting, I think, that many of the terrorist groups don't even want to use the word Israel. And so what do they refer to as? the Zionist entity. They're right. It's a Zionist entity, but they don't mean it historically. Zionist is a term, unfortunately, I believe, that many Jews feel uncomfortable with, in part because they don't know what it means, but also because of political correctness, which has completely defined the way a lot of people think in this country. A lot of professors, a lot of government officials, etc. I think it's important to be brave and not to cave into political correctness, but say what it is that you really believe. When I discuss this topic around the country and I ask Jewish audiences what Zionism means to them, they frequently answer incorrectly that it means the obligation to move to Israel, and I do not believe that. A Zionism is the ideology that claims that there should be a Zionist state, not that every Jew must live there. As the frightening 21st century unfolds, and we have Holocaust-denying dictators such as Ahmadinejad pronouncing that he will drive Israel into the sea, and conferences on human rights hijacked to denounce Israel, the challenges are great to keep focused on what the Zionist task is. Based on everything I've read, this is what I think Zionism should mean for the 21st century. In its two sentences, Zionism is the ideology or set of ideas that claims that, based on the Bible, Jewish history, the Balfour Declaration, and the United Nations vote, among many other factors, Jews are entitled to a state of their own, and that it is the duty of all Jews everywhere to protect that state. Because Israel is a Jewish state where Jewish culture should flourish, Zionism requires that it develop according to the highest ethical principles, and that it protect its citizens, and that it particularly be a vibrant democracy that protects the rights of any and all minorities, and that it works towards peace with its neighbors. This definition does not require all Jews to move to Israel, nor does it require all Jews who live in Israel to stay there. It does, however, provide us with three essential tasks. One, to study and understand Jewish history and the history of Zionism. Two, to be able to defend the state verbally, financially, and politically. And three, to help Israel develop ties of friendship and support throughout the world. The 28th Zionist Congress met in Jerusalem in 1968 and adopted 5 points of the so-called Jerusalem Program as the aims of Zionism today. I'd like to read those. They are to foster the unity of the Jewish people. So Zionism deals with this unity of the Jewish people, even unrelated to the particular state. And to foster the sense of the centrality of Israel in Jewish life. Two, to promote the ingathering, to promote, not to force, to promote the ingathering of the Jewish people in its historic homeland, Eretz Israel, through Aliyah. Three, to strengthen the state of Israel based on the prophetic vision of justice and peace, which is wonderful. Four, to preserve the identity of the Jewish people through the fostering of Jewish and Hebrew education and of Jewish spiritual and cultural values. And five, to protect Jewish rights everywhere. Two of my points, that Israel be a vibrant democracy that protects the rights of any and all minorities, and that it work toward peace with the neighbors, were not really articulated, I want to make sure, yep, were not articulated in the 1968 statement. So I wrote this in 2009. To me, the difference between that and what I said demonstrates that Zionism is an ever-changing and evolving ideology that responds to the issues of the time. Zionism in the 21st century presents us with an enormous challenge. And the more we educate ourselves about what our Zionist foremothers and forefathers have done, the more we will be able to be up to the task. Thank you. Uh, I think I'm supposed to answer questions, which I will gladly do. Please make them easy. Does anyone want to ask a question? Yes, sir.
Assuming that Israel will only really remain a Jewish nation, and that's the purpose of it. The purpose of it was to be a Jewish nation. If Jews are in the majority, certainly the majority, certainly Muslims not in the majority. What's your view on the whole
the demographic problem?
No, the whole occupied territory issue.
Okay, well the. The question was, what is my view on the occupied territories in terms of the demographic issue?
Well, in terms of the survival of the country.
In terms of the survival of the country. Well,
if that continues.
If I had the answer to that question, I would get the Nobel Prize, you know. But it's very complicated because although I think the majority of Israelis are saying that they would forego the West Bank and obviously Gaza, which we have given to the Palestinians. In fact, Israelis are the only people who have given the Palestinians a land of their own. Nobody else did it. But most Israelis would like to see the IDF out of the West Bank. But there is for demographic reasons and also because of the impact of actually having to rule over other people, which is not good for people to have to do. But the problem is the settlements, not future settlements so much. I'm not so worried about those because they seem to be probably diminishing, but the current settlements. How many people here have been in the West Bank lately? You, the two of you. Jakey, you don't have to answer every question. yeah, you have. So have you seen some of these settlements? They are enormous. The one, Kiryat Arba, for example, right outside of Hebron, or Ariel. These are enormous. They are cities. They are huge places. How they are going to be uprooted is very difficult, and or if at all possible. And it could be that the only thing that will happen is some very clever exchange, some sort of way in which Israel can still have control over those areas that are in the middle of the West Bank, and maybe the Palestinians can have some control over some of the Arab population in exchange in Israel. The trouble with that is the Arabs in Israel don't want to be controlled by the people in the West Bank. So it's not like we can solve this problem immediately. We have to probably do it step by step. And I think the first big step is to see, and I'd like to just answer the question by saying something else, if that's okay. We all know, I hope, that the one-state solution is a terrible idea because that's the end of Israel, right? Because it's no longer a Jewish state. The two-state solution seems to be everybody's new favorite, not you. seems to be, people seem to think that that's the solution. I'm very suspicious of the two-state solution. Just a minute. I'm very suspicious of the two-state solution because the opportunity, because in the West Bank, the Arabs seem to be only slowly beginning to have law and order. And right now, if they became a state, I don't think they would be ready to live in peace with Israel. There could only be a two-state solution, I think, after maybe another 5 years, at least, where cities like Jenin and Bethlehem and other places where there's police, there's law and order, there's sort of economic development, and then there can be a state. And then perhaps we should only have a two-state solution if there is a peace treaty that's connected with that at the same time. But just to say a two-state solution, you get this, we get that, I don't think it makes any sense whatsoever. It was voted on in 1947, as everybody knows, by the UN, a two-state solution, and the next day there was war. So I don't think we're there yet. We're maybe close, but we're not there yet. Yes?
You think that the curriculum for a Zionist education should now include
Do I believe that a education about Zionism should include principles of international relations?
Jews should understand the very power that they bring or should bring to negotiation and the whole principle of realpolitik in the life of nations, rather than operate kind of in a vacuum. I don't know if I make myself clear.
Sure. I mean, first of all, it's good to learn. It's good to learn. So if it requires, if you're saying, should we learn about international realpolitik, that's fine.
Understand the reality of the struggle that Jews have in today's political context.
Sure, definitely. My husband always says that this whole problem would disappear if they discovered oil in Israel. You know, so that would be an international perspective on it. But the clearly, we have to understand the connection between Israel and its dependence on the United States. We have to understand the role of Russia. We have to understand the role of China. Definitely. The more we can understand, the better. Another question? Yes.
Yes. Can you tell me if there would be, for the post-Zionists, for the generation of young Jews now who don't know what a struggle is, what a miracle a state of Israel is, will there ever be programs in Zionist or Israel education, or Israel studies, or Zionist studies, rather than just Jewish studies?
Where?
Anywhere. Tell me, where
is it going
to start?
Okay, I didn't know if you meant Israel or you meant...
No, I mean here.
You mean here. You heard my husband say that he introduced the history of Zionism as a course at the University of Michigan, and you heard this was somewhere between 72 and 82 when we were there, and that distinguished historians said to him, there is no history of Zionism, that is not a field. So the first thing he had to do was really demonstrate that it was a field. And I think that if one of the things that you can do, most people here went to college, right? Look at what your alma mater is doing with regard to this. Is there a course on the history of Zionism in the college? And if not, suggest to them that maybe they would do such a thing. Second, with regard to adult education, you have to have this, and you should make sure of it. I think that the day schools are now recognizing that it's necessary. This is kind of new. The day schools didn't used to teach history of Zionism. And the other thing there is a project that I'm involved in, or a program called the David Project, which teaches young people how to defend Israel and what Zionism is all about so that they can talk about it. A lot of young people get into these arguments with people who oppose them and they don't know how to answer. So there's a lot of, there's sort of activist training and then there's just intellectual work, et cetera. I hope that answered you. Yes?
One more question.
Okay, sure. Could we have two, because this lady also said.
I'm wondering if you see a trend in anti-Zionism.
Absolutely.
Young people and a feeling of guilt that Israel is taking away rights of the Palestinians. And what can we do about that attitude, countering?
How to counter the attitude of young people who feel that what Zionism has led to is a diminishing of Palestinian rights. Well, one of the things you can do is study the impact of the occupation on the Arab population. We, for example, at Brandeis University have a connection with a university in the West Bank called Al-Quds. Al-Quds is Arabic for Jerusalem. And we can see the first of all, women going to colleges, universities being expanded. You could talk about the health statistics. You can talk about all sorts of things that show how, although it is still very difficult to live under a military regime, nobody's going to deny that, the quality of life for a lot of people has improved. And the particularly in those cities that I mentioned before, Jenin and Bethlehem, although the Christians have been driven out because Muslims are trying to gain control of this area, nevertheless, there is improved economic conditions, improved safety and law and opportunities for tourism, et cetera. So you could talk about it that way. I mean, you could go into blame. You could blame the Palestinians for attacking, for the suicide bombs. You could go all that. But the blame approach doesn't lead you anywhere. It just makes you feel, perhaps, that these other people are terrible. But what are you going to do? They're your neighbors. You've got to figure out some way to live with each other. And I think that, I don't know if I was clear enough, but I think that's one of the Zionist tasks now, is to, you know, you think that just now we have a difficult time figuring out what to do with regard to Israel? It was like this from 1880 on, when the first people came to live there. There was no economy for a while. There was no health services for a while. There was no recognition by other countries. It was always difficult. And our difficulty now is to figure out this dilemma that you were talking about. And we have to do it with a positive perspective. How can we positively move forward? Because a mutual blame just doesn't get us anywhere. Yes?
You mentioned about talking to universities about teaching about Zionism. My daughter goes to Berkeley.
Berkeley?
Yes. I went to a class with her, Near East Studies, and then I followed the professor, and I took a CD, I think Charles David, you're talking about the David Project.
No, that's something else, but it doesn't matter.
The Forgotten Refugees.
Oh, yes. David Project produced The Forgotten Refugees.
Right. The Forgotten.
You're thinking about Charles Jacobs, is that what you said?
Charles Jacobs, I meant, yes. Sorry.
It's okay.
I went to the professor, I said, do you talk about the other refugees like me? And he said, no. He said, why? Do you know about it? Yes. And why don't you? Well, if you want to leave that CD, we'll discuss it. And I asked my daughter, it was never, ever mentioned. What can we do about this? I could go and tell him, schmuck, but
that's not good. That's not useful, particularly if he's bigger than you.
Just say, you know, there were about a million of us, 700,000 of them. I think it's important for the course. This is Berkeley.
I know. It's almost impossible, I think, to change the views of people who are already entrenched in an anti-Zionist view in teaching. But what Brandeis is very engaged in this, is to take teachers who don't yet have a point of view, and bring them to Brandeis in the summer, and we really teach them how to teach about Israel. The younger ones, people not maybe in the Middle East Center, but maybe in English or in, you know, something related in a way. We bring them, I think we've trained 150 or something. How many people? 130. We bring these people to Brandeis and we teach them how to teach. And they cannot be admitted to this program unless their provost or dean or somebody says that after they receive this training, they are allowed to teach a course. So when and then we take them for, I think it's 2 weeks at Brandeis and give them a fabulous education. Then they have to make a syllabus. Then we take them to Israel and we introduce them to everybody, and then they have to revise the syllabus, and then we help them teach the course, and you know, all those kinds of things. So that's again the positive. Because it's almost impossible to get these people, particularly if they're tenured.
Well, they're tenured.
You cannot take a professor who's teaching something and say, teach it a different way. That's just not how it works. But
how about
you
teach it?
What?
How about teach it? It. Not one side of it, but it.
I would love it, but I'm just saying you can't do that. You can't force a professor to teach differently, but you can train new teachers, and that's what we're doing. Yes. So, Todarabat, Shabbat Shalom.